Other victims of the economic miracle are the Bugis, Dyaks, Melanesias, and other indigenous cultures. Their lands have been stolen and their lives and traditions destroyed. This modern genocide cannot be measured solely in terms of human suffering. It is an attack on the soul of humanity, and especially discouraging in light of earlier genocides, including ones conducted in the United States against our indigenous people. While those are condemned today, the model is repeated and financed by the U.S. government and our corporations. When the growing economic crisis began to severely impact his country, Suharto bought into the IMF Structural Adjustment Package, SAP. The IMF recommended that Suharto drop fuel and food subsidies and many other social services to decrease spending. Blatantly imbalanced in favor of the rich, these policies resulted in increased starvation, disease, and antagonism. Masses of Indonesians finally took to the streets. Even the wealthy, fearing increased mayhem, demanded change. Suharto was forced to resign in May 1998, ending his 32 years of dictatorial rule. In September 1999, the Clinton administration severed all military ties with the Indonesian military. However, these events by no means marked the end for the corporatocracy. On the contrary, they ultimately strengthened its position. Indonesians in power took credit for ousting the dictator and portrayed themselves as friends of the people. The U.S. government and multinational corporations hailed Suharto's downfall and supported the new regime. Then, on December 26, 2004, a tragedy occurred that would provide new opportunities for the corporatocracy to entrench itself. The day after Christmas, the tsunami struck. Around 250,000 people would ultimately die from the huge waves. However, the businesses involved in the reconstruction, many of them U.S. firms, saw the devastation as a profit-making occasion. Earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis kill hundreds of thousands of people and destroy property, yet they boost GDP. The death and destruction does not make it into the economic statistics books. Yet, the billions of dollars spent on reconstruction do, creating a falsely positive impression. Most U.S. citizens are not aware that national disasters are like wars. They are highly profitable for big business. A great deal of the money for rebuilding after disasters is earmarked for U.S. engineering firms and for multinational corporations that own hotel, restaurant, and retail chains, communications and transportation networks, banks, insurance companies, and other corporatocracy industries. Rather than helping subsistence farmers, fishermen, mom-and-pop restaurants, bed-and-breakfasts, and local entrepreneurs, disaster relief programs provide one more vehicle for channeling money to the empire builders. Chapter 8. Tsunami Profiteering. December 26, 2004 was a black day. Not only for the immediate victims of the terrible tsunami, but also for all of us who believe in compassion, charity, and goodwill to our fellow inhabitants of this planet. The tragic story behind the shameless exploitation began several months before that natural disaster struck. Indonesia selected another military man as president in September 2004. General Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, according to the New York Times, moved swiftly up the ranks during the authoritarian rule of General Suharto. He had been chosen for military training at Fort Benning, Georgia in 1976, and completed two tours in the United States under the International Military Education and Training Program. After the tsunami, he became the perfect leader to shatter the independence movement in Aceh Province. Like many of the local movements throughout the archipelago, the one in Aceh was driven by a desire to gain independence from a government that was viewed as economically exploitative and brutally repressive. While their environment and culture suffered at the hands of foreign corporations, the people of Aceh received few benefits. One of Indonesia's largest resource projects, a liquefied natural gas LNG facility, is located in Aceh, yet only a tiny percentage of the LNG profits are directed to local schools, hospitals, and other investments that would help those most adversely impacted by the venture. Resource-rich Aceh has been yearning for independence from Indonesia for 5 decades. According to Melissa Rossi, an award-winning journalist who has written for Newsweek, Newsday, Esquire, George, MSNBC, and the New York Observer, and who occasionally sends me personal emails from global hotspots. Oil wells line the coasts, which explains why the Indonesian government is clamped onto Aceh like a leech. Although few records were released to the public, an estimated 10 to 15,000 people were killed during 30 years of fighting in the province before the tsunami swept out of the ocean and across the land. Secret talks between the government and the Free Aceh Movement, GAM, GAM, in Indonesian for Gerakan Aceh Merdeka, began in 2004. GAM appeared to have gained a bargaining position that would allow the people of Aceh to share some of the profits generated from oil, gas, and other local resources, a degree of local self-rule, and other rights demanded for decades. However, the tsunami changed all that. Because GAM was a local organization centered in the area destroyed by the giant waves, it was seriously impaired by the chaotic aftermath. Some of its key people died or suffered the loss of family members. Its communications and transportation systems were devastated. It redirected its activities away from the resistance and bargaining processes and into caring for tsunami victims and managing recovery efforts. The government, on the other hand, moved quickly to take advantage of the pandemonium. Fresh troops were flown in from Java and other unaffected areas of Indonesia. Within months, they would be bolstered by U.S. military personnel and mercenaries like Neil, the ex-CIA operative who headed up a team that guarded U.S. contractors. Although the armed forces took command under the pretext of relieving disaster victims, their unspoken goals included quashing GAM. The Bush administration wasted no time. In the month after the tsunami, January 2005, Washington reversed the 1999 policy implemented by Clinton that had severed ties with Indonesia's repressive military. The White House dispatched $1 million worth of military equipment to Jakarta, the New York Times reported on February 7, 2005. Quote, Washington is seizing on an opportunity that came after the tsunami. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has moved to strengthen American training of Indonesian officers considerably. In Aceh, the Indonesian army, which has been fighting a separatist rebellion for 30 years, has been on full display since the tsunami. The army's uppermost concern appears to be to keep a stranglehold on the armed forces of the Free Aceh Movement. Unquote. In November 2005, Washington lifted the arms embargo and resumed full relations with the Indonesian military. Exhausted by their efforts to recover from the disaster and help local communities rebuild, and faced with overwhelming pressure from the Indonesian army and its U.S. supporters, GAM signed a very one-sided peace treaty with the government. Once again, the corporatocracy was and is the big winner. The tsunami virtually assured that the exploitation of Aceh will continue unabated. A cogent example of the way natural disasters are exploited by the corporatocracy is offered by Aceh's Loser ecosystem. For 3 decades, local resistance had kept lumber and oil companies out of one of the world's richest forests. Now that GAM has been crushed, the region is reopened to exploitation. Mike Griffiths, a former oil company executive, left his lucrative job and devoted himself to ecological conservation in the mid-1980s. He helped found the Loser International Foundation in 1994. He guided NPR's Radio Expeditions program to Aceh in 2006. Radio Expeditions host, Michael Sullivan, reported, "With peace, the pressure on the forest is likely to increase, and the biggest threat, even more than logging of valuable tropical hardwoods and oil palm plantations, is roads." The radio program went on to explain that immediately following the tsunami, U.S. engineering and construction companies lobbied the World Bank and other aid agencies for money to construct these roads, which will primarily serve the lumber and oil industries. Mike Griffiths told NPR, If you lose the Loser ecosystem, you don't only lose the last real chance for the tiger, the orangutan, for the elephant, and for the rhino. You lose the basic foundation for the welfare for 4 million people. That is how many rely on this place for water, flood protection, and erosion protection. Unquote. The relationship between Indonesian ruling elites, the U.S. government, and international corporations is indicative of methods employed by the corporatocracy around the world during the post-World War II era. Empire building has been conducted largely in secret. Since democracy assumes an informed electorate, these methods pose a direct threat to America's most coveted ideal. They also serve as a disturbing commentary on the results of my work and that of so many development experts. The insidious nature of our work was highlighted for me personally by three separate incidents. They were exposed after the 2004 tsunami, although the roots of each reached back into my earlier career. Chapter 9. Fruits of Corruption. In Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I describe my connection in the late 1980s and 1990s with Stone & Webster Engineering Company, SWEC, SWEC. At that time, one of the nation's largest and most respected consulting and construction firms, and the fact that I was paid about $500,000 by SWEC with the understanding that I would desist from writing a book about my EHM life. Occasionally, the company asked me to actually perform a service for them. One day in 1995, a high-level SWEC executive called to request a meeting with me. Over lunch, he discussed a project to construct a chemicals processing complex in Indonesia. It would be, he assured me, one of the largest projects in the company's 100-year history, worth about $1 billion. "I'm determined to land this one," he said, and then, lowering his voice, admitted, "but I can't do it until I figure a way to pay one of Suharto's family members $150 million. "A bribe," I responded. He nodded. "You've spent a lot of time in Indonesia. Fill me in on how to make this happen." I told him that I knew of four ways to pay the man a legal bribe. SWEC could arrange to lease bulldozers, cranes, trucks, and other heavy equipment from companies owned by him and his friends and pay excessive fees. They could subcontract portions of the project to similarly owned companies at inflated prices. They could use that same model to contract for food, housing, cars, fuel, and other such items. And they could offer to arrange for the sons and daughters of the Indonesians' cronies to attend prestigious U.S. colleges, cover all their expenses, and pay them consultant or intern salaries while they were in the United States. Although I acknowledged that arranging for such a large sum would probably require all four approaches and would take several years, I assured him that I had seen all of these schemes used very successfully and was unaware of any legal actions ever taken against a U.S. company or its executives as a result. I also suggested that he explore the idea of retaining geishas to help seal the deal. "The geishas," he informed me with a conspiratorial grin, "are already hard at work." As to the rest, he expressed concern that Suharto's man wanted cash up front. I had to admit that I knew no way to make such amounts of cash available up front, at least not legally. He thanked me. I heard nothing further from him on this issue. A decade later, on March 15, 2006, the Boston Globe carried the following banner headline across the front page of its business section: "The Bribe Memo and Collapse of Stone & Webster." The article told the tragic story of how the company's glorious history, which began in 1889, came crashing to an end when it filed for bankruptcy in 2000 and ended up owned by the Shaw Group. According to the Globe, quote, "Well over 1,000 employees were fired, their savings in Stone & Webster stock lost." Unquote. Globe reporter Steve Bailey concluded that the downfall could be traced to, quote, the critical memo that lays out in detail a previously unreported secret attempt by the company to pay an illegal $147 million kickback to a relative of Indonesian President Suharto to secure the largest contract in Stone & Webster history. Unquote. The second incident started with an email I received from the son of an Indonesian government official whom I had worked with during the 1970s, requesting a meeting with me. Emil, not his real name, joined me at a quiet Thai restaurant on New York's Upper West Side. He told me that he had been deeply moved by confessions of an economic hitman. His father had introduced him to me in Jakarta when he was about 10 years old. He remembered hearing my name often. He knew, he said, that his father was one of those corrupt officials I described in my book. Then, looking me squarely in the eye, he admitted that he had followed in his father's footsteps. "I want to come clean," he told me. "I want to confess like you." He smiled softly. "But I have a family and a great deal to lose. I'm sure you understand what I mean." I assured him that I would never divulge his name or in any way expose his identity. Emil's story was a revealing one. He pointed out that the Indonesian military has a long history of collecting money from the private sector in order to finance its activities. He tried to make light of this, shrugging it off with a laugh, observing that such activities were common in third world countries. Then he grew serious. "Since the fall of Suharto in 1998, things have gotten even worse. Suharto was truly a military dictator who was determined to keep the armed forces under his control. Once his reign ended, many Indonesians tried desperately to change the law so that civilians would have more power over the military. They thought that by reducing the military budget, they could accomplish their objectives. The generals knew where to go for help: foreign mining and energy companies." I told Emil that his words reminded me of similar situations in Colombia, Nigeria, Nicaragua, and so many other countries where private militias are used to supplement national armies. "Yes," he agreed, "we've got many mercenaries in Indonesia. But what I'm talking about is worse. In the last few years, our army's been bought out by foreign corporations. The implications are frightening because, you see, these corporations now own our armed forces as well as our resources." When I asked him why he was divulging this information, he turned away and looked outside the window of the restaurant at the passing traffic. Finally, his eyes returned to meet mine. "I'm a collaborator. I've taken my father's corruption a step further. I'm one of the people who make the arrangements, collect the money from companies, and pass it on to the military. I'm ashamed. The least I can do is talk to you and hope you let the world know about what's going on." Weeks after my meeting with Emil, an article caught my eye as I scanned the New York Times website. It detailed the activities of a New Orleans-based company, Freeport McMoRan Copper and Gold, that made payments of $20 million to military commanders and units in the area, Papua, in the last 7 years in exchange for protection of its facilities in the remote province. The article went on to assert that, quote, "Only one-third of the financing for Indonesia's armed forces come from the state budget, while the rest is collected from non-transparent sources such as protection payments, allowing the military brass to operate independently of the government's financial controls." Unquote. That article led me to two others that had appeared on the Times website in September 2004. They described recent events in my old stomping ground, Sulawesi, documenting allegations that the world's largest gold-producing company, Newmont Mining Corporation, based in Denver, was illegally dumping arsenic and mercury into the ocean at Buyat Bay. As I read these articles, I realized my work, the electrical systems, roads, ports, and other infrastructure that we EHMs financed and built back in the 1970s, had created the conditions that enabled Newmont to conduct its mining activities and poison the ocean. As my project manager Charlie Illingworth pointed out on my first trip, we were dispatched to Indonesia to make sure the oil companies got everything they needed. It did not take long for me to understand that our mission was not limited to oil companies. Sulawesi was a prime example of how aid money benefits the multinationals. The Times article pointed out that, quote, "The fight with Newmont has fueled a growing popular impression that mining and energy companies hold a tight grip over Indonesia's weak regulatory system. Many blame the corruption, cronyism, and unevolved legal structure inherited from General Suharto, the dictator whose rule ended in 1998, and who, for a price, eagerly opened the doors to foreign investors." Unquote. As I stared at those articles, the allegations by the mayor of Batesville and the boogie shipbuilder superimposed themselves over my computer screen like biblical prophets come back to haunt me. The United States had indeed sent its bats off to exploit and pollute foreign lands. Sailors on ancient wooden galleons, armed with machetes, had little chance of defending their homeland against the might of the Pentagon, or against the more subtle armies of corporate henchmen.